alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools, homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever. Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least 5 mines in Fars province. Esterlal Abade Company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties. There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has 3 factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions. Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius. The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-grade fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the Research and Development Department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported. Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramic ware such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries. The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market. Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports composed some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metal sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. Catalysts are the unsung heroes of the chemical reactions that make human society tick by. They help speed up chemical processes between molecules that might have been taken years to interact. Factories rely on catalysts to make everything from plastic to drugs. Catalysts also help process petroleum and coal into liquid fuels and are key players in clean energy technologies as well. However, their biggest use happens in the oil and gas industries.
All right, everyone, now I will pass it over to my colleague who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's take a look.
You definitely have a clear image of a concrete or a steel structure, but when it comes to tensile structures, you most likely cannot picture anything. They're self-standing structures, carrying only tension and no compression. Mostly made of membrane or industrial fabrics, they're most often used for roofs and canopies, creating unique private and public spaces. Mahout is the name of an Iranian company that makes all kinds of tensile structures. Tensile structures can cover vast areas. While they're lightweight compared to other types of construction, they're extremely strong. Tensile fabric structures are designed and engineered to withstand even the most severe weather conditions, providing protection from both rain and sun. Mahout says its products are made using the latest technology and high-quality materials, on par with their international peers. Mahout has under its belt a dedicated team of experts who are constantly exploring new trends and efficient designs for eye-catching yet resilient tensile structures. While the Iranian brand has a strong foothold in Iran's market and is eyeing higher horizons, Mahout says it's working to undertake international projects. Offering a unique landscape for outdoor eateries, restaurants, and coffee shops, tensile structures are beginning to attract more attention in the architecture industry. This means the future market will be lucrative for the actors in this field. And Mahout says it will stand out, as it believes quality is in the details.
There is so much more that can be said about knowledge-based products, so let's take a look at some news and trends in this field. You have probably heard the phrase NFT, or non-fungible tokens, being thrown around recently. The very first Iranian NFT issuance platform was established and launched in the country.
The platform is called Bita. It was created by a company in the field of developing digital technologies in the information communication technology sector. Bita digitally certifies artistic and non-artistic works in the form of non-fungible tokens. The developer says it plans to increase international access and grow the platform's ecosystem to determine accurate asset values. People can purchase NFT that are backed by authentic art approved by the system and sold at auction.
Most people don't think twice about fungi, but what if it could be used to help treat diseases? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company has managed to come up with the technology to produce rare medicinal fungi.
This company focused on producing four species of medicinal fungi. Once cultivation conditions have been established, these plants can be mass-produced. Its medicinal properties will be used in the form of tablets and capsules. These fungi have the potential to treat liver disease, immune deficiencies, diabetes, and some skin diseases. Plus, the four species can now be cultivated in 3 months.
The number of cars and pollution increases as cities grow, and one way to manage this issue is to create specialized technology. Domestic knowledge-based companies and startups have developed 17 innovative products to improve road traffic and reduce air pollution.
The products were developed to address the rising number of vehicles and inner-city trips in cities nationwide. Some of these smart products are used to record traffic violations, collect traffic information, and license systems for restricted traffic zones, among many others. Smart traffic monitoring systems have also been developed by these companies.
We are fresh out of time for our program for today. Thank you for tuning in.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt has made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost the British taxpayer overall more than £500 million. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered his heaviest defeat in the House of Lords after the Archbishop of Canterbury and former Conservative ministers joined forces with the opposition to force through 5 amendments to the Rwanda deportation bill. The string of government setbacks, most passed by unusually large margins of about 100 votes, means the legislation which aims to clear the way to send asylum seekers on a one-way flight to Kigali in Rwanda will have to go back to the House of Commons. The Prime Minister has previously warned the unelected chamber against frustrating the will of the people by hampering the passage of his Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill, which has been approved by MPs. Rishi Sunak has made stopping the boats a key pledge of his leadership. However, he has been hit by several setbacks, including the bill being challenged in the courts of law. Recently, official auditors said it will cost £1.8 million to send each of 300 migrants to Rwanda. The draft legislation and a treaty with Rwanda are intended to prevent further legal challenges to the stalled deportation scheme after the Supreme Court ruled the plan was unlawful. As well as compelling judges to regard the East African country as safe, it would give ministers the power to ignore emergency injunctions. It has been warned that the legislation is fundamentally incompatible with Britain's human rights obligations and would flout international law. But No. 10 Downing Street has said the government remains committed to sending flights to Rwanda in the spring. In all, peers backed 5 changes to the bill recently, including ensuring it complied with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty with its promised safeguards is fully implemented. The Lords also supported a move that would allow the presumption the country is a secure haven to be challenged in the courts of law. Among those to vote against the government were the Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, and Conservative grandees Kenneth Clark, Lord Devon, and Viscount Hailsham, who have all previously held cabinet positions. The size of the defeats raised the prospect of an extended tussle between the House of Commons and the House of Lords during ping-pong, in which legislation is battled between the two houses until agreement is reached. The barrister and independent crossbencher David Anderson said the provision in the bill requiring Rwanda to be treated as safe takes us for fools. Proposing an amendment that would allow the presumption to be challenged in the courts of law, Lord Anderson added, "If Rwanda is safe, as the government would have us declare, it has nothing to fear from such scrutiny." The Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, said international human rights law had developed following the horrors committed by Nazi Germany to act as a fallback and stop on governments. The Archbishop said, "We are not in any situation remotely like that, let's be clear," adding, "The government is not doing something on the scale of what we saw at that stage, but the government is challenging the right of international law to constrain our actions." Lord Kenneth Clark, the former Chancellor, said he hoped there would be a legal challenge to the bill if it was passed. He said, "I cannot recall a precedent in my time where a government of any complexion have produced a bill which asserts, a matter of fact, facts to be fact. Later, responding to concerns about the mental health support asylum seekers would receive in Rwanda, the Home Office Minister, Andrew Sharp, said, "It would be far in the best interest, mental health interest of those seeking asylum and who are victims to seek asylum in the first safe country they come to." The government recently faces the threat of further defeats when the bill is again before the House of Lords. Britain and France are planning to establish a new customs partnership designed to disrupt the supply chain of small boats in the Channel. Recently, James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, hosted a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, of the Calais Group of Northern European countries. They plan to disrupt the supply chain of boats, parts, including engines and building materials. Website Reddit has also covered the same story. Not surprisingly, in his budget, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost British taxpayers overall more than £500 million. As the National Audit Office has revealed, for each of the first 300 people that will be flown to Kigali, Rwanda, it will cost a staggering £1.8 million. It is hard to believe that it was almost 2 years ago, in a speech in the Rwandan capital, that Priti Patel, the then Home Secretary, presented the UK-Rwanda deal to the world as a so-called groundbreaking agreement. Yet the government is still trying to get more laws through Parliament to make it happen. Having already passed the Illegal Migration Act, which, as was made clear by the UNHCR, amounts to an asylum ban, the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill is now reaching its final stages, with the House of Lords voting to radically amend it recently. Prominent peers, including those on the government benches, expressed deep dismay that the bill rides roughshod over the rule of law by overturning the Supreme Court judgment that Rwanda is not a safe country to which to send people seeking asylum. Lord Tugendhat, the Conservative peer, whose nephew, Tom Tugendhat, is a Home Office minister, lambasted the government for behaving like the ruling party in George Orwell's 1984. The barrister and independent crossbencher, Lord Anderson, pointedly said the legislation takes us for fools. In all, peers have made 10 changes to the bill, including ensuring it complies with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty that governs removals to the East African country, which includes safeguards, is fully implemented. The laws also made important amendments to ensure far greater protections for victims of modern slavery and human trafficking, and for children whose age is disputed. The bill will return to the House of Commons in less than 2 weeks, and the government will certainly reject all the law's amendments. The word in Westminster is that the only very modest concession No. 10 Downing Street is prepared to offer is to put in place an independent monitoring mechanism. This would replace the current arrangements for a monitoring committee that has already been appointed by the UK and Rwandan governments and includes those supportive of the policy, such as Alexander Downer, a former Australian politician who has been a vocal advocate for the new legislation.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murderer in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany, and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. Her suggestion that pesticides are, in fact, biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history, as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people. But the reality is, Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientists for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
4 packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! You, wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this. Yeah!
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, "We're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer." In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named "Smoking and Health: The Need to Know" was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, "Is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong?" A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They published different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. But those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Tigo, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says there will be no agreement with the Israeli regime before full cessation of its aggression against the Gaza Strip and withdrawal of all its military forces from Gaza. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The head of the Political Bureau of the Palestinian Resistance Movement Hamas says there will be no agreement with the Israeli regime before full cessation of its aggression against Gaza and withdrawal of all its military forces from Gaza. Ismail Haniyeh made the remarks in a televised speech on Sunday evening, 10th of March, on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan. Haniyeh said, "We do not want an agreement that does not end the Israeli war on Gaza Strip or ensure return of our displaced people to their homes, or an agreement that does not guarantee the withdrawal of the Zionist enemy from the Gaza Strip." Ismail Haniyeh stressed that any agreement with the Israeli regime must also address humanitarian issues in Gaza, including provision of relief, aid and shelter, as well as reconstruction of the territory, while ending the Israeli siege and guaranteeing a dignified deal for the exchange of prisoners. Ismail Haniyeh added, "We absolutely do not want an agreement that does not address humanitarian issues of our people, especially in the northern Gaza Strip, where children, the elderly and women are dying because of hunger imposed by the enemy." The head of Hamas's political bureau added that the movement has shown the highest degree of positivity and responsibility in order to achieve an agreement based on these principles. Haniyeh noted that any possible agreement should be implemented in three stages and must include international guarantees to oblige the occupying regime to abide by it. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ismail Haniyeh emphasized that the Zionist enemy bears full responsibility for not reaching any agreement during the ongoing talks, as it avoids giving any clear guarantees. Haniyeh said, "I tell you clearly, responsibly and impartially that the enemy has so far refrained from giving clear guarantees and commitments, especially with regards to stopping its war of aggression against Gaza." Haniyeh affirmed that Hamas and its leadership are open to continuation of negotiations and any formula that would end the aggression against Gaza and Israel's crimes against Palestinians. In his speech, he also mentioned that Hamas will not compromise on any drop of blood of a child, woman, elder, or fighter from our people. Meanwhile, the Israeli military have attacked hundreds of Palestinian worshippers heading to the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Quds to perform Taraweeh prayers, preventing their entry into the sacred site. Eyewitnesses said the Israeli military detained Palestinian citizens at the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Sunday evening attack, 10th of March, and impeded their access to it, according to the Palestinian Wafa News Agency report. Israeli military have also imposed restrictions on young men entering Al-Aqsa Mosque to perform Taraweeh prayer, only allowing women above the age of 40 to enter. The Israeli regime has been imposing a strict siege on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and blocking Palestinians' access to it since 5 months ago, when it started its war of genocide on the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel has also issued dozens of deportation orders against Palestinian residents of the city of Al-Quds to prevent them from praying during the holy month of Ramadan. Reacting to the regime's restrictions on the holy site, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement issued a statement on Sunday, 10th of March, warning that Israel is playing with fire. The desecration of the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque by the occupation and the settler gangs and their restriction on the movement and access of Palestinian worshippers to it is playing with fire. Meanwhile, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reiterated that the Yemeni nation's unflinching support for the Palestinian cause, emphasizing that the country's armed forces will continue their retaliatory strikes in the Red Sea during the holy month of Ramadan. Speaking in a televised speech from the Yemeni capital Sana'a on Sunday, 10th of March, Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the Yemeni naval forces will press ahead with their campaign in solidarity with the Palestinians. He praised the people of Yemen for staging mass pro-Palestine rallies across the country on a weekly basis. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the demonstrators who converge on the Al-Sabin Square in Sana'a every week are doing a great job. They're treading the righteous path, he said. The Ansarullah chief went on to describe participation in pro-Palestine rallies as highly important, noting that the mass rallies send a clear message to the enemies that Yemeni operations against the Israeli regime, United States of America and Britain, particularly with regards to ships in the Red Sea heading for Israeli ports, are supported wholeheartedly by the Yemeni population. He said it's a matter of pride for Yemenis to be recognized as the noble warriors with a clear understanding of the Muslim world's sufferings and miseries of the oppressed Palestinian nation. VOA News has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Israeli regime and the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas have traded blame over the deadlock in negotiations just before Ramadan, which begins on or around 10th of March and is observed by Muslims worldwide. A Hamas source told the Reuters news agency the group's delegation was unlikely to make another visit to Cairo, Egypt over the weekend for talks. Egypt, the United States and Qatar have been mediating negotiations since last January. Under a draft of the current ceasefire agreement, 40 captives would be released in exchange for dozens of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas blamed the Israeli regime for a deadlock in the negotiations, saying it refuses to give guarantees to end the war or to pull all its military forces from Gaza. Israeli officials have said the war will end only with the defeat of the resistance movement Hamas. In a statement on Saturday, 9th of March, just before the start of the blessed month of Ramadan, Hamas's political chief Ismail Haniyeh vowed the Palestinians will continue to fight the Israeli regime until they regain their freedom and independence. Meanwhile, dozens of Palestinian families in the southern Gaza city of Rafah were left homeless on Saturday when the Israeli military struck one of the largest residential towers there, claiming the block was used by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The Israeli attack on Rafah has stepped up pressure on the enclave. At least 1.5 million Palestinians have taken refuge in the southern Gaza city of Rafah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why is the month of Ramadan superior to other months? May 19th, 2018. We should move forward and we should accompany our movement with divine intentions and with the intention of getting closer to God. We should know that if we apply these methods, God's assistance and blessings will be definite. The month of Ramadan is an opportunity for gaining piety, and the purpose of fasting is that you may learn piety. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 183. Allah, the Exalted, has commanded us to fast with this purpose in mind. At least one of the purposes of commanding people to fast during this month, fasting is one of the important characteristics of the month of Ramadan, is to exercise piety. In daily du'as, after saying prayers, we read, And this is a month on which you bestowed greatness, dignity, and honor, and on which you bestowed superiority over other months. Allah the Exalted has made this month superior to others. One of the reasons for this superiority is the act of fasting. Another reason is that He sent down the Holy Quran in this month. Another reason is the night of Qadr. These things have been mentioned in this dua as characteristics of this month. This is good ground for our growth and fruitfulness. It is like the springtime. As each season of the year has certain natural characteristics, some seasons and sometimes days, nights, weeks, and months have certain characteristics for growth and for the spiritual dynamism and the transcendence of the people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Dear friends, the month of Ramadan is a very good opportunity. It is a very good opportunity. It is an opportunity to do promotions, promoting